Hi, I'm your host, Rowan Tonkin, and welcome to Being Planful, the show for FP&A leaders and planning experts. Hi, welcome to the Being Planful podcast, and my name is Rowan Tonkin, and I'm really pleased to be joined here by Brian Lapidus. He looks after the FP&A practice at AFP, the Association of Finance Professionals. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Rowan. Happy to be here.
So before we get started, and I know we've got some really great topics to cover today, but I did want to just give everyone an understanding of you and your background. You've been an FP&A professional, and now you're really evangelizing a lot of that work at AFP. And if you could help introduce yourself to the audience.
Sure. So I have been 20 years in the office of the CFO. I've been in large companies like American Express and Fannie Mae. I've been in mid-sized companies, private equity-backed companies, and consulting. And in that background, I've run FP&A. I've been in treasury. I've been in risk. So all around the office of the CFO.
Well, that's great. And how has that translated into your role at AFP?
Well, I think about my role as I have the responsibility to create and curate content for the membership. So for me, I think about what I would have needed to know or what would have been helpful to me when I sat in that chair, either at running FP&A or any of the other steps leading up to the head of FP&A or even the relationship with other parts of finance. I feel like I've sat in that seat in various versions of that seat long enough. So I kind of know, I know what I didn't know then, and I try and plug those holes today.
That certainly makes sense. And as we think about, you know, the role of FP&A today, that's obviously changed immensely over the last, you know, 6 to 9 months. How do you, when you're speaking to the membership, do you get a sense of how the FP&A community is holding up right now, given they've probably felt like they've been planning and replanning, and now we're about to enter yet another planning cycle for everyone? Can you give us a sense of how the community is holding up?
Well, I'll tell you, in the month of August, it was really hard to get a hold of anybody. People did a good job, I think, of taking time off before entering the new budget cycle, because you're right. March, April, May was a continuous cycle of forecasting and reforecasting and all the what ifs. We really saw in our surveys, we had a response to COVID survey, and then this past summer, a more detailed FP&A kind of benchmarking survey. And we really saw that the number of forecasts that went up, that we did, increase significantly. More weekly forecasts, more daily, weekly, and monthly forecasts. All of it translated into more work. And so how are people holding up? There is a real burnout factor by the beginning of summer, because the workload was always immense and the stress around it was high. So I think in August, people really did a good job of kind of taking a pause. And now here we are, call it the last week of August, early September, mid-October, people are back in the throes of planning cycles. And what we're seeing, again, from our data, from our survey, is that the expectation for forecast cycles for next year is going to remain at that elevated level that it did this year. So the pressure and the pace is not going to decrease. Partially, I think people just got used to having the survey and the forecast, and they don't want to give that up.
Yeah, and that's certainly something that we've seen from our end. And with that in mind, is that something that you predict will carry on? Is that frequency of decision making and data availability? And would that be kind of one of the lessons learned from 2020 that we can do this?
So I agree with most of that. Yes, this pace is going to continue. Again, that's the expectation. It's in our forecast survey, and nobody likes to ever give up information. And in some ways, FP&A has kind of put itself in a bit of a tough spot by being able to deliver, right? People now say, oh, well, you did it before, keep it going. The challenge is that process of getting around that decision wheel from data to analysis to action, right? The faster you can get around that wheel, the better it is. It increases the velocity of the business. For the past 6 months, we have really been doing it with whatever tools and processes that we had before. At some point, we need to, in order to get better, to get faster, and to make more decisions to increase that velocity, we're going to have to use better tools or become better at the tools that we already have.
Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of taking that next step, I know you've got the AFP conference coming up. It's virtual this year, and you've got some amazing guests, Daniel Pink and Shaq. You know, I was looking forward to seeing Tony Hawk at the in-person event. I was hoping there was going to be a skate ramp and a 900, but I believe you've pushed that to 2021. So we'll get him to do a 2021, right, at the event.
I want to know, if I build a skate ramp, will you go on it?
I would go on it. Yeah. I'm not sure I'd go on it with a skateboard, but I'll go on it for sure.
All right. I'll hold you to that.
I'll take a BMX bike. I used to do a lot of that as a kid. But what can folks expect from the event? I know we're just a couple of weeks away. I'm sure you've been deep in planning for that event and talking to a lot of the guests and speakers. Can you tell us a little bit more about the event?
I always think of our conference as the all-you-can-eat buffet for finance and treasury. We have six different tracks. We have more than 130 sessions, somewhere around 100 vendors. We're really proud of the event that we're able to put on and bring to the membership and to the finance community. On the FP&A side, you know, every year there's always a lot of submissions. We're very fortunate to have so many submissions and people wanting to come and speak. But every year there's always a bit of a theme. And what we heard loud and clear this year is how does finance work with operations, right? In other years, it might've been about big tech, and we still have sessions on that about managing large data sets. But this year in the submissions and in what the planning task force chose, it's how do we work with the business? How do we get their input? How do we get their partnership? And in some cases, the answers or the presentations, mostly practitioner-led presentations, are their experiences with the technology that allows that integrated planning, the partnership, the personal partnership of how to work with people and how to sit and how to invite them as part of your thinking process. How to make use of their expertise. And so that finance ops cohesion really is an important subplot in the FP&A track.
And is that one of your predictions as we move into kind of 2021 and beyond, and we take some of those lessons learned about what you just said before around, you know, we've been kind of making do with what we had, and we've been trying to deliver that as fast as we can because the business demands that. As we move forward into 2021, is that something that you're seeing FP&A really take that kind of lens of being a little more tactical historically, potentially? I know that's something that you've talked about. Your benchmark data historically always says, well, we're going to go from tactical to strategic this year. And it's been that way for a while. Is that something that you're seeing, you know, genuinely going to change this year with what we've seen?
It will. And the reason is that finance is moving out of this zone of just financial data and being able to incorporate more. And we see it in how the world has changed. So I'll get back to that. But if I were to step back, what I would say is that the world has sped up, and the need to respond real time to the market has sped things up. The unpredictability of the year that we've had has sped things up. So people need to have that reforecast that we talked about. They need to have different contingency planning and contingent resources. And so as a big picture, what we would say is that finance's response to the unpredictability of the world, of the information, is not to have a single point of view, not to have a single forecast or a single outlook, but instead to hold multiple points of view at the same time. That's really how you're ready for anything. And so we see that in three different fronts. we see that in terms of how finance gets done. The finance acumen that we use and that we apply, we think is going to change. So instead of a single NPV, maybe it's a range-bound NPV. Instead of a single budget, maybe it's scenarios that you have to have multiple scenarios. Well, once you have multiple scenarios, then how do you value those scenarios? If you have a single valuation for that, you lose the optionality of turning something on or turning something off. So we see that even some of the math may change to option valuations. So you're going to need, so if that's what you're going to apply, you're going to need the technology and the tools that will get you through your decision cycle faster and will support you in a different way. So we're seeing that software has often built in a lot of statistical analyses. Well, that means that you have to know how to apply it, which means you have to know some more about statistics. We're seeing the need to forecast on demand, right? There's a new event. You have to have an event-driven forecast. So on the technology side, you have to have your data in place. You have to have your systems in place that will allow you to make the decisions faster, to reforecast faster, and to incorporate. And then as far as what we need as individuals, you hit on one of them, right? That need to be close to the business to get that information that only the business has, because they're the ones who are closest to the market. But it's also this sense that it's more important, the data is out there. The answer, the data, we do not suffer from a lack of information. So because the information's out there in so many different forms, it's actually more important to ask the right question than it is to hoard the answer. Because asking the right question is going to help you navigate through this sea of data, figure out what you need, and then figure out the answer. So those are really the three things: the financial acumen to be in many places, the technology to get around the decision wheel faster, and defining work more important than doing the work. Those are really our three insights or predictions, if you will, for the next couple of years.
Sure. And what advice would you give to FP&A leaders or emerging FP&A leaders in terms of expanding the financial acumen of their business partners as well? Because I think that's one of the key things that we certainly see is, as finance leaders go out to the business, they need to do a lot of education as to why they're asking these questions and really kind of give that insight into what the question is leading to ultimately.
Yeah, it's that need for finance to be bilingual, right? Mm-hmm. You have to speak business, but you have to be able to speak about finance. And even more so, as I just laid out, you have to be maybe even more statistically oriented than we had in the past, which makes talking to the business a lot harder, right? How often does the business come back to finance and say, just give me the number? Well, it's not just one number, right? The number is based on a certain set of assumptions, and we have high belief in some assumptions and less in others. So let's talk about these assumptions. And the answer, because there is no single answer, it's being able to lay out what the assumptions are and have the business own those assumptions, right? The more that they own the forecast or the inputs to the forecast, the more they're going to believe it, the more they're going to act appropriately. Well, in order to do that, that's where you get to the business partnership that you had brought up, right? You have to explain it to them probably several times, and you have to do it in a way that's, I'm just gonna be really blunt here. You have to do it in a way that's not demeaning. Mm-hmm. You can't talk down to them. I'll give you an example. I spoke with somebody recently, and she was telling me she was brought in as she was a former CFO. She also teaches statistics. So she was brought in as an expert on this one certain topic. And so she sat down, she listened to the business, and she said, okay, well, here's what I see. And she laid out statistically what they would need to do. But she got this feeling that they just didn't respond well to her. So she talked to somebody offline in the evening, and then it went back in the morning. She said, look, I got some feedback that you guys thought that, you know, here comes statistics woman going to tell all the dumb business people what they don't know and what they should be doing. And she said, that's absolutely not what I meant. you guys are the ones who are running the business. Yes, I have this statistics background, but that's what I'm bringing to help you. That awareness, you know, the EQ to listen and realize when you're not being heard or when you're being misheard, the shared responsibility of saying, here's what finance does and here's what we do well, but here's what you guys do. And you guys are making the money, you're in the business, you're in with the customer. The ability to put that together is really, really the definition of good business partnership and the role that finance can play and the value that we can add.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things in my conversations that I have a lot with business leaders is the thing that you mentioned first, which was assumptions, right? And, you know, if you go to the marketing team versus the sales team, the assumptions about the growth plan for next year may be two completely different assumptions. And so it's getting everyone on the same page with those assumptions first before we even enter the planning process, because then we can start to assume, okay, well, based on what we know, this is scenario A, this is scenario B, as a shared assumption model. And that's one of the biggest failings that I see as people enter planning processes like what we're about to have, especially now when we think about what's going on, everyone's assumptions are wildly different right now. And that may depend on industry, it may depend on region, and that is going to be a key, I think, for planning for 2021.
Finance also assumes that people understand modeling well, right? We assume people understand the assumptions and what's nailed down and what's not nailed down. And so when we give people the output of a model, they say, okay, here's the model. This is what finance is telling me. We found that there's actually a gap between what core finance believes and what senior finance believes about how people know and understand modeling in general. Mm-hmm. Core finance has a much higher estimation of people's understanding. Maybe that's one of the reasons why the senior people are senior is because they realize if you're not deep in the model, it feels a little bit like a black box, right? One of the things that we've advocated for a while is having multiple models. Now, in some cases, maybe it's multiple scenarios. And there's there's some literature out there about how many scenarios you should run. You know, someone says you should always run at least four scenarios to force people not to choose the middle one, right? Force people to take a position and not be comfortable. Actually, at conference, we have a great session with somebody who talks about running a naive forecast, right? Which is basically a trend-driven forecast versus all of the other inputs that people give. And actually what he did was he tracked over time the naive model, right? So a statistical speak for if you just did nothing and did the minimal amount of work. And then the analyst review, the senior analyst review, and then the management review. And he said, which was the most accurate forecast? So whose review of the base naive model added or destroyed value? And so by doing that, he was able to go back to the different people who gave input and said, okay, historically over time, this is more accurate, this is less accurate. The data tells you this, the on the top adjustments tell you that. And so by putting a rigorous measurement methodology on there, he was able to really address that issue that you talked about. Whose data do you believe, who's most accurate, right? Who do you listen to, and how can you make those meetings more productive?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, in terms of those types of conversations, as you highlighted earlier, we're not lacking for data anymore. We're actually probably suffering from too much and therefore applying the same value to pieces of data, I think, where we just say, well, it's all data, it all has the same relative value, and therefore its output will have the same value. But one of the things that you talk about a lot is data fluency. Can you explain what this is to our audiences and why it's important for all budget owners?
Yeah. Data, so there's data fluency. I think about it in two ways. One is as the individual, the ability to speak data well, but then it's also, it's how data flows throughout a company. So overall, what I say that I think data fluency is the ability for individuals in a company to produce and consume data with minimal friction, right? And that last part's important because we are producing data. Every time I take a spreadsheet from some, or take a download from somebody, put it into a spreadsheet, manipulate it and put it back in, I've created new data, but I've had to go through friction points in order to do that. The more that we can have systems that everybody uses, right? The mythical common source of single source of truth, right? The more you could do that, the more you reduce friction. So what you need to have are the data sources, uses, and conversions and calculations be understood, be as minimal as possible, as few conversions, so that there is that single source that people can trust. And you need to have people who think data first. So at your senior levels, that means decisions are made based on data. So they start demanding the data and they start demanding the quality data. And it means that you need to have really controls and processes in place for when it gets created, how it moves, who owns certain calculations. And in some of this work is really dramatically not sexy, right? Defining your data calculations is not, you know, is not the most fun. Putting data owners, sitting around the table and hashing out what are the right calculations, or what is the definition of a calculation? Because you may find that sales and marketing may have a different definition of a customer, or finance comes in and says, okay, well, I need everything to align to the general ledger, and operations is over here and says, well, we've got an entirely other computer system. And so there's a tremendous, is one of the largest friction points is between operational and financial data, because now you've got to reconcile. So how do you reconcile? Well, you've got to sit down and argue about it, and then you've got to build some other data mart somewhere, or you go back and download it to a spreadsheet. You go have your transformations and, you know, put it through your ETL and bring it back up. It's a real painful process. I'll give you one example of a company that I think did a great job. They're explaining how they built this data lake. So data lake says, the company says, look, we are one of the largest companies in the world. Trying to manage all the sources and all the different databases is hard. So they built this data lake, and they finance said, okay, we will control everything that goes in. Other people in the company can pull the information out because it's been vetted, right? We can't guess every possible use of every manager everywhere on the globe, but we can make sure that what goes in is standardized. And they spent, I think it was 3 years, defining all the calculations, defining all the sources, defining how it could be used. So from there, it's everything that's in the lake is vetted. All the different databases are vetted. But because of that, they now have empowered people on the other side to use it because they understand and because they have confidence in what's in the lake.
Yeah, I was about to say the purity of the water in the lake is crystal clear, right? So now it's easy to drink, it's easy to consume, no one has to clean it. All of that just makes 100% sense.
Yeah.
And as you think about 2021, and I'm going to ask you for some particular trends or predictions. But are there any that you're seeing and hearing from the market that you don't agree with?
You know, everybody talks about AI and what it is. Boy, you're really putting me in a tough position here, right? If I say I disagree with something that comes true, boy, it'll be awkward. But I'll tell you that someone, I don't know where I picked up this quote, but somebody said that AI is anything that's 50 years in the future. So you hear so much about what is AI and it's going to come in this year and it's going to be this and it's good that. The flavor of AI that people are talking about now is really machine learning. And machine learning, when you break it down and you look at what it is much more understandable. AI, people get a little worried about because it's this sense of, you know, it's the Skynet robots and the Terminator robots. So when I think about it that way, I think machine learning is very understandable. It's very real. And we can, because of that, we can see what its strengths are and its limitations and its flaws. So I think that machine learning will come in and will be a big thing. So I don't worry too much about AI. The other thing that I guess I'm a little skeptical, maybe I just need somebody to really show it to me well, is the idea of, you know, there's a common phrase out there that we're moving from historical to descriptive to predictive and prescriptive analytics. And I think, first of all, the data on where we are today is we're certainly not there today. I think roughly less than 10% of companies have something like that in place today. But the reason why I'm a little skeptical is that prescriptive analytics is essentially a set of regressions that look at historical data and say, this is what we've seen in the past, and therefore this is what you should do in the future. Well, it's a little bit like AI. That's very understandable. Here is a trend analysis. And I've seen software that will go and it'll run through 300 different kinds of algorithms, and it'll give you the whole winters or the AREMA or whatever the forecast trend is, right? So I've seen that. And that's one of many different options. And then I've seen where a little bit different, right? That's usually internal. Looking on the external markets, here's all these different, maybe it's the national GDP, maybe it's the regional GDP, and we'll run a regression relative to that. Okay. Predictive analytics in its current state and its state for the next few years, I think is really sophisticated regression analysis. And when you look at it that way, you can understand its strengths, you can understand its weaknesses, and then it just becomes another tool that the analyst says, okay, I believe certain trends will continue. I think certain things won't. But in this world of fast changing, fast paces, black swan events every few years, you have to really wonder about how much the future is going to look like the past, which is the base of regression, which is the base of a lot of these predictive analytics.
Yeah, I in between working for two different planning software companies, I took a little sojourn to an accelerated analytics company. And one of the biggest challenges that data scientists ultimately have is building the models with enough features and the predictability of those features that go into the model to create the right outcomes. And I think when we talk about it, certainly in FP&A, we're dealing with an inch level of features that we're sticking into the model to predict outcomes, right? It's, 48 different time periods prior. It's, different account structures, whether they're nested or whether they're aggregated. And there's so many other different features that could drive that change in behavior that any output is limited because we're not accepting, to your point earlier, enough of the data that exists externally to actually make that outcome more real or more reasonable. Yes, will it give you a broad base to start planning from? Could it give you some numbers to help you understand, some level of order of magnitude? Of course. But I think, given that experience from me, we're a long way away from what you're talking about, which is the true AI, if you will, where it's becoming much more prescriptive, because we're not at the point yet where FP&A leaders and FP&A teams have the strength of data science capabilities in-house to actually build those outcomes with the level of predictability. I'm not sure if you would agree or disagree with that, but that's certainly as an outsider and kind of a marketing leader and a revenue operations leader, I get sold a lot of AI and ML tools. And I don't think we're there yet either. And I struggle to see how my peers in finance would be at that level either.
Yeah. So financial data, so many things have to happen before you get to the bottom line of the financial numbers. So if you are trying to predict things based on the general ledger, right? So, well, some things are pretty stable, so it's easy to predict rent, right? That's right. But you don't need an AI machine, just look at the contract and
that may have changed this year.
Yeah, right. Or there it is, because all of your historical data suddenly has been blown away. There's a great quote at our FinEx conference. One of the keynotes said that machine learning is and all the AI that we have today is great at finding a needle in a haystack, but it's terrible at finding the tornado that's going to come over and blow your haystack down. Right. And that's what the rent question is, just what you described. Sure, it could tell you in great detail what your rent forecast is going to be until everybody starts working from home and people cut their leases. So I agree with you. I think that starting with the financial data is a difficult place to make your long-term financial forecast. So you move to the operational data. Well, there's all of your internal data, but you know, so much of what happens is based on market forces, right? Just, you know, in financial speak, you'd say that your beta is what drives your stock valuation. And, you know, it's very hard to find the alpha, to find that management changes that really set your company apart. So the market. Well, then you start looking at the market and you say, okay, we are living in a VUCA world, right? VUCA is the acronym that says information is volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. Ambiguous means cause and effect are really hard to find. So then people say, okay, we'll just get more numbers. Let's expand the view and bring in even more data. So that's great. So now you've got not three variables. Now you've got, as you said, 48 different variables that will help, that you'll put into your model, right? So now you've measured the multicollinearity of 48 different variables, and it predicts something, and something changes, and you say, okay, so something changed. Which variable was it due to? Why did it change? That unpredictability, that inability to find cause and effect, right? That is part of what we're seeing as the trend. It's hard to really know what's going to happen. So you have to be ready for everything. And you might believe you're putting more science into your forecast model by bringing in 40 different variables, but then do you really know what's driving your business? So all of these things, kind of getting back to, I think that prescriptive analytics has a really hard road coming up. I don't think we're there yet. I love the idea, I love the potential of it, but I don't think that we're there in the next 12 to 24 months.
And so what advice, or what maybe even at the event coming up, what are people talking about the actionability and how they should be thinking about leveraging AI and more specifically, I would say ML, I would agree with you, leveraging ML today, because it certainly does help folks with, you know, doing things just that little bit faster, starting them from an earlier place in time and giving that advantage. Just to, you know, computers are great at calculating numbers and humans make mistakes all the time. So where would you advise people to start? Or is there any sessions that you could point, you know, AFP members towards?
Yeah. So ML is a tool, right? There was a time that Excel was the new technology, and Excel was great and it made things so much faster. And now it's ubiquitous. We don't even think about it. We are going to get there with machine learning and with so many of the other new technologies that are out there. So you can't be afraid of it. You just have to realize what it is that you're going to do with it. And there are certain things that it can do better than you can. In one session we have coming up, the speaker is talking about creating scenario plans, and he actually has R programming language and Excel, and he runs through an example side by side with the two, and then he says, this is the point where Excel fails. You could run all these different regressions in Excel, but you'd have to run them one by one, whereas in R, I just ran, you know, 37 different regressions simultaneously to find out all my correlations. And then also Excel had a limit of 16. Well, I've exceeded that, so I've been able to go beyond that. So it's a tool that you're just going to have to get used to and use and learn how to use and use better. One of the other things, and I don't want to give away too much from conference because it's going to be great, but one of the other sessions where the speakers are going to talk about the fact that you that different parts of your forecast can be treated differently, right? There are some things that are low volatility and there are some things that are high volatility. So how do you put your time and effort in the things that are, that require the most judgment, the most human intervention, right? When do you go and you, when, which are the areas that you go and you sit down with a business and you talk to them and say, all right, what's really gonna happen? And what are the ones that are best for putting on autopilot, so to speak? So we have a lot of very tactical sessions that will help people think through those issues.
All right, well, I don't wanna keep you too much longer, but you know, I'm certainly looking forward to the conference. I know there's going to be great sessions. I'm attending from my team's perspective, and I'm sure my finance team will be going. Is there anything that you want to leave us with that maybe I didn't get a chance to ask today, Brian?
You know, it's easy to say this, but it's hard to do this, right? It's that sense of when we look forward and how are you managing that unpredictability, right? How do you hold the multiple points of view? It's that we as individuals need to be flexible. And whether that means that the Excel that we learned before, you know, when we were younger, that's all we know, there's new functionality and there's new features in there. And if you're using a SaaS-based system, right, it's not just enough to know how to put your numbers in. Really get in and use it. We need to be flexible. We need to be growing all the time because the technology is changing. And because of that, the processes that we're going through are changing. So part of being ready for the future and holding these different views of the future means that we're going to be different selves. Ourselves as professionals are going to be different in the future. So get your education, get your continuing learning, get your conversations and contacts with other people who can help push you and keep you learning. Because we are not finished products. We are always improving.
Yeah, and that's certainly something that we want to keep the podcast focused on, is how do you keep improving and how do you keep learning? And thank you very much for the session and the content. I'm sure our listeners will find it really valuable. So thanks again, Brian. I hope to have you back on and look forward to the AFP conference coming up here in a few weeks.
Great. Rowan, it was a real pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Bye. Make sure you hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast so you don't miss an episode. Thanks for stopping by.